Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids. Some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I just, for me, I always, on television, watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton?
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to Passcast. This week, we're telling the story of the first cross-country race in America. There were no roads back then. Imagine if you had to make it across the U.S. with a horse cart powered by a Briggs & Stratton lawnmower engine. And that's what these cars are. So, really fun one. Bart's here.
Hi.
We got a cool letter from some badasses over in Japan. They sent us this patch and some snack. It's a good one. So sit back, relax, and here is Ask Gas. On June 21st, 1904, a beaten-down one-cylinder Oldsmobile runabout rattled into Portland, Oregon. 44 days earlier, it was one of two similar machines that left New York City in pursuit of a $1,000 prize and the ability to say they had won the first cross-country automobile race in American history. Not an easy task at the time. The race was a publicity stunt, both for Oldsmobile and for a government program dedicated to building good roads across the country. That program was necessary because along their journey, our Oldsmobile drivers spent as much time digging themselves out of the mud as they did driving. They also fell down ditches, crashed through bridges, slipped into sinkholes, burned through the witches, and got trapped by hogs. They roasted in the desert, had nosebleeds in the mountains, and were forced to take cover under their cars to avoid the hail. Oh. And they also got lost. A lot. Why did these four men decide to spend 6 weeks on the road in misery? How could a rickety Oldsmobile make it across America under its own power? And why did every single guy on this trip have the weirdest name ever? That's exactly what we're going to find out in this episode of Past Gas. Welcome back to the show, everybody. My name is Nolan Sykes, joined this week by Bart Bidlingmeyer, Bids Bardo.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And Joe G. Weber.
Slime off a slug's back. Her hair.
I love it.
Right. Bringing it back.
It's on his business card.
Her hair.
All right. So let's get one thing straight right off the bat about America's cross-country road network back in the early 1900s. It didn't exist. Over in Europe, where centuries of conquest and settlement carved plenty of well-known paths across the continent, point-to-point racing took off pretty quick. The Paris-Rouen distance rally took place back in 1894, and that kicked off a whole slew of city-to-city races designed to test the reliability of that brand-spanking-new European machinery. Granted, it was still very tough to make it from the tip of Portugal up to, say, the northern end of Germany, but you could definitely find some decent enough roads to get you there.
Yeah, we did a wheelhouse a long time ago about Roman roads.
Yeah.
It didn't do very well.
It did not.
But it was very interesting to research because the Romans paved all these roads all across Europe, all the way to, you know, Turkey, up to Ireland, whatever. And they had a really stout version mm-hmm. of road that lasted a long time. And so they, when it came time to like repave it, they just used these existing the Roman roads.
Wow.
Yeah.
So back in America or over in America, that didn't exist. Indigenous communities here didn't feel the same desperate need to tame nature that the Europeans did. So while there were locally recognized paths between settlements, no one was trying to pave the world. And when the Europeans turned up on the coast with the idea that they might just build a life over here, it still took a couple centuries before there were enough people to keep a little town up and running. The first official party of Americans to take a peek at the Pacific Ocean didn't even get there until 1805. By the turn of the 20th century, though, it was clear that something needed to change. And what better way to prove it than with a good old-fashioned sporting contest? Now, there are two different origin stories for this cross-country race. One says that it emerged from the mind of a man named James W. Abbott, who was a special agent for the Rocky Mountains and Pacific Coast region in the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Office of Public Road Inquiry. That's a long title. Basically, in that role, he was able to work with a new government company called the National Good Roads Association. He chatted with a few folks who had attempted to drive across America solo, and he thought hosting a publicized race would be a pretty simple way to get the word out about America's dire need for roads. The second origin story claims it was the National Association of Automobile Manufacturers. They had an idea to test the, quote, feasibility of a national highway. And so an Oldsmobile sales manager chatted with James W. Abbott to get the whole thing organized. However, things happened.
It's a chicken and egg argument here.
Yeah.
It happened. They both had the same idea.
Yeah, it's not that far off, too. Like,
it's really like 3 degrees of separation.
We say that, and yet our comments are going to be like,
if you know anything about James W. Abbott, you would know.
You literally did any research at all for this episode, you'd understand.
It was, and we didn't. We're just winging it.
However the events occurred, the shape of the race began to come into being in 1905. Abbott laid out a map that roughly followed some railroad routes, and it was determined that only two cars would take on this adventure, both piloted by two drivers. Since Oldsmobile had a hand in the race organization, those cars would naturally be Oldsmobiles. Big newspapers picked up on this adventure, and the New York Times interviewed Abbott about the goals for this whole endeavor. Quote,
"Is this, am I old-timey voice, or am I really driving?
Old-timey,
a modern take on an old-timey guy.
The Good Roads Movement is absolutely necessary to make the automobile more popular,"
Abbott told the Times.
"And if the two cars now starting to succeed in making the trip on time, which will be within 44 days, I think it will pave the way for future trips around the continent by many private motor car owners who undertake the journey, perhaps more leisurely, for pleasure."
The whole goal was to start the race as late as possible in the year.
I also say just a funny, like, people did talk that way.
Yeah.
Like, we watched these old movies, but it was...
like, so verbose.
Yeah.
It's like, it was, dog.
It was an
give
effort.
Give me the cliff notes.
They were basically like, everybody from every other country has a way they talk.
Yeah.
So let's figure ours out. And it just didn't take.
I'm listening to this, this book on tape for... Into Thin Air, mm-hmm. which is like a firsthand account of the deadliest season on Everest. And even back in the 90s, when this book was written, everything is like so flowery. And it's like, dude, just cut this sentence in half.
Can we make this a TikTok?
The whole goal was to start the race as late as possible in the year in hopes that snow-capped mountain ranges would be easier to pass, but early enough to give the competitors a chance to arrive in Portland, Oregon, during the midst of a convention hosted by the National Good Roads Association.
I also love the name. They're like, welcome to Good Roads, home of the good roads. It's like the weird, the simplest name for what do we want? Good roads. Okay, let's make it that.
Where do we want them? Nationally. The first car to reach Portland would earn a handsome prize of $1,000, which was twice the annual average wage, while the loser would still get to keep his car. There were no...
Would you want it after a cross-country race?
I mean, it depends. If it's a piece of junk and broke down on you and all that, you'd be like, f*** this car. But
that's the thing. Oldsmobiles were like one of the first to be a reliable car.
Yeah.
And like we, you know, they're like, no one even thinks about them now. Yeah. Right. Like the last cool one was maybe a Cutlass or an Alero. But like Oldsmobile was like the big player this early on. And then like it took a couple of years for Ford to be on the scene. Mm-hmm. We talk about Oldsmobile a little bit in the Dodge episode because they were manufacturing transmissions and engines for them at the time. But yeah, they were reliable, like well-known company.
And it was the first, it was, you know, Model T gets the kind of the halo ads. That's the first car to make it accessible to, they just took the Oldsmobile curved dash to the next level. And this was, Oldsmobile had streamlined it. The curved dash was the affordable option.
Though there was no extra prize for doing so, both cars were hoping to beat a 33-day transcontinental record that had been set in a much more powerful air-cooled Franklin in 1904. And on May 8th, 1905, 50 years before the birth of my dad.
Same day, though?
Same day. Nice. Our four competitors set off from New York City in hopes of making history.
My dad is 2 months older than your dad.
Really?
Yeah.
Nice.
Same day, though?
Same day.
Same day.
Whoa.
Weird. Every year.
Every year. Both teams would be driving the same 1904 Olds runabouts that were pulled right from the showroom floor in exactly the same spec. Both had the same one-cylinder, seven-horsepower engine. Both had a top speed of almost 30 miles an hour. Dang, these are basically go-karts.
Yeah.
The cars had tillers instead of steering wheels, and they could carry 100 gallons of fuel. Oh, my God.
Which would last them 30 miles.
That's hilarious, dude. Seven horsepower. We have a one-cylinder engine in the shop right now where we're going to build or use on our go-kart build that makes 12 horsepower, you know. Doesn't have 100 gallons of gas on it, but...
Yet.
We'll be right back after these messages.
Stop the podcast!
Stop the podcast!
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids. Some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I just, for me, I always, on television, watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton?
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.
Now back to the show.
Olds Motor Works produced a damn fine car back in its day, even if it wasn't exactly what we'd consider high tech today. A Parisian named Maurice Fournier had actually driven his own Olds 3,000 miles around Europe within a month to win a $20,000 bet, and he hailed it as, quote, is something more than a car for city streets and World Cup parks.
$20,000 is like
$1 billion
back then.
I feel like we've talked about Mr. Fournier in the past, maybe on the show or on a Wheelhouse or something back in the day. But yes. But would the Oldsmobile survive the wilds of America? Well, that would come down to its crew. Our first car was nicknamed Old Scout, and it was to be piloted by two men named Dwight B. Huss and Milford Weigel. Huss was born in Detroit and raised in Clyde, Ohio, getting his competitive start racing bicycles in 1890. But that two-wheeled experiment ended in his first race. As Huss told Life magazine,
"A chicken flew right into my drivetrain and got wrapped around a sprocket. I lost the race. I quit bicycle racing a long time ago myself."
Dwight B. Huss started racing automobiles. And in 1903, he won a gold medal driving an Oldsmobile in the English Reliability Trials. Allegedly, he became a regular importer of Oldsmobiles into Europe, setting up agencies and dealerships in major European cities and promoting the cars by entering himself in races across the globe. When it came time for Oldsmobile to select two drivers out of a pool of 100 entrants, well, Huss just made sense. His co-founder, Milford Weigel, also had racing experience between 1902 and 1904. He won 3 gold medals and 3 silver cups in various races.
12 silver cups.
12 silver cups, I'm sorry.
Yeah, don't short him.
In 1905, he was an Olds factory mechanic, meaning that he was tasked with keeping Olds Scout up and running throughout the excursion. The second car in our little competition here was known as Olds Steady and was piloted by Percy F. McGurgle.
Percy F. McGargle.
Percy F. McGargle. And Barton Stanchfield. A bit like Huss, McGargle's first love was the bicycle. But unlike Huss, one poor race didn't nip his career in the bud. Rather, he was so dedicated to his two-wheeled pastime that he even edited and published his own magazine, Side Paths, between 1897 and 1902, in and around the time he was attending military school in Aurora, New York. But Percy F. McGargle made the
McGargle.
McGargle. But Percy,
you know, like the bad guy in the Smurfs,
Gilgamel.
Yeah, there's Gargamel. That's why he's having trouble.
Gilgamel. You're talking about Gilgamesh.
I'm thinking of Gilgamesh. Gargamel.
Think of it like this. Think about it like if you have a sore throat.
Yeah.
What do you do? McGargle.
McGargle.
And you're in the lighthouse, the movie.
That's right. But Percy F. McGargle had made the move to four wheels, and in 1904, he took an Elmore Tonneau pathfinding car on a 1,200-mile journey from New York City to the World's Fair in St. Louis, then turned right back around to do the whole thing all over again in a two-cycle Elmore. Clearly, this was a man who knew some challenges of cross-country driving, and so it makes sense that Old selected Mr. McGargle for the task of heading all the way to the West Coast.
Dude, guys will never change.
Guys are just being dudes in this, right?
Guys
now.
Are just being dudes. Yeah.
Besides McGargle,
I'm going for a drive slam.
Sitting next to McGargle on the trip was Bart Stanchfield, who, like Milford Weigel, was an Olds factory mechanic. His whole goal would be making sure that Olds Steady arrived to the West Coast in one piece.
You were right about these crazy names. Bart?
Are you weird. Bartholomew or no. Just Bart?
I'm Brian Arthur.
So
it's the B from Brian and from Arthur.
Your real name is Brian?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Whoa. I've known you for like 12 years.
Yeah. Nobody not.
Nobody's asked.
Well, sure. But also, I mean, anyone I've ever worked for has had to sign my checks, so they've known. But
Brian Arthur.
No, as long as I can remember. Because I'm a junior. Brian Jr.
Oh.
So really early on, my dad was, you know.
Does he go by Brian?
Yes.
Okay. He's like, there's no way in hell exactly. I'm being confused with this little...
Well, or it'd be like, Brian, what? Talking to the baby Brian.
Yeah.
He's like, first, if this is happening now, this is going to be long.
Yeah.
So we got to think of a new name. Let's see what can we call him. So pretty he's good. Bart.
Wow. Yeah. That's cool.
So as long as I can remember. And then It's like every year going to school, mm-hmm. I had to be like, actually,
write me down as Bart.
Call me Bart. And then I had a teacher in eighth grade or something, and he was like, no.
What?
And I was like, well, everybody, I don't call people nicknames. I'm like, look, I'm trying to tell you. This is going to get real tiring for you.
Yeah.
Because if you say Brian, I won't know. My brain, I am Bart. And everybody, and then everybody else is like, yeah, he's, you know, like everybody's trying to defend me. He's like, no, principals. And then after like a month of him like, what do you think, Brian? Silence.
Oh my God.
Yeah. He's like, he thought I was f***ing with him. Yeah. He's like, no, I really, so you it's broke not him down. In here.
Is this the Quixote guy?
No, that was college.
Oh, okay.
Quixote. Yeah.
Quixote. wow.
That's a digression.
Anyway, it was good. Bart. So Bart Stanchfield was also an Olds factory mechanic. We know this. So we know a lot less about Bart's story, but we do know that there was tension right from the start. You see,
Bart's not just in the drive chain.
Bart Stanchfield worked in a Lansing, Michigan Olds factory, while Weigel worked at a factory in Detroit. And according to Automobile Magazine, the two men were said to have fostered a, quote, keenest rivalry so that each party can be relied upon to do everything that is fair to finish the tour first.
That's funny because Lansing is very close to Detroit, right?
Sure. Yeah.
In the grand scheme of things. Yes. So it's funny that
there is the rivalry between, it's like the rival high school.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like the two rival quarterbacks.
Both Oldsmobiles clocked in at around 800 pounds, but they crested over 1,000 with the addition of a steamer trunk strapped to the back seat that Automobile Magazine said was filled with luggage, tools, and parts.
I'm picturing if they've got a rivalry. He's like, do you really need this jacket? I can't believe how much stuff you brought on this trip.
Detroit's made you soft, huh?
Oh, you Lansing boys in your jackets.
Along with that, the cars were equipped with one spare tire and a swivel searchlight to help them see, presumably in the dark. Behind the wheel.
What? I like that.
Behind the wheel, our drivers and their mechanic opted against packing any additional clothing. They'd wear the clothes on their backs until they were so rank that there was no option but to throw them away and buy something. That is some guys being dudes stuff.
That's
right there.
Be dudes. Yeah. That's like the apartment that has a bed on the floor and a TV.
That's like when, like instead of like washing your socks, you just go to Ross and buy a pack of new ones, which I did a couple times.
I had a friend who did not have enough change to do both the washer and the dryer. And so he thought that putting his socks in the dryer would
kill everything.
Yeah. And they just made him really hot and really stinky. Yeah. And I had to be the one to be like, hey, man, this is not, I'll give you four quarters.
Interestingly, even though the cars were supposedly the same, they were outfitted with different tires. Old Scout used Fisk tires, and Old Steady used Diamond. An Old Steady was also said to be heavier just because of the fact that McGargle and Stanchfield outweighed Huss and Weigel.
When McGargle you're doing, seems like a stout guy.
Yeah. When you're saying the weight of the cars, I was like, if one of these dudes is 400 pounds, that's half the weight. You know, like two, you know.
Yeah. 400 pounds was easily the fattest average man that ever lived.
No, that
back
was the
then
average. I've seen pictures.
Still, they're about as equal as could be. And for the first time in American history, two cars would be competing against one another in a cross-country race with a handsome cash prize waiting for them at the end. Don't drive your Oldsmobile 100 miles the first day. Such was the sage advice offered by the Oldsmobile owner's manual at the time. Quote, you wouldn't drive a green horse 10 miles till you were acquainted with him. Do you know more about a gasoline motor than you do a horse?
Condescending. I know. Owner's manual.
So hilarious.
And then it's also like, maybe?
Yeah, I don't know.
I think I do. I don't know much about horses. I
don't know what goes on inside the mind of a horse.
Yeah.
Our four protagonists were some of the few people in America who could firmly answer those questions stated by the Oldsmobile manual with a resounding yes. And on the first day behind the wheel, they traveled 200 miles up to Albany. Theoretically, if the weather stayed pleasant, our competitors would have a smooth excursion into the Midwest. However, that is not what happened, because on the first night, it rained, and the unpaved roads of upstate New York were drenched. Quote,
owing to the mud guards having been stripped from Old Steady and Old Scout, we were soon covered from head to foot with mire,
McGargle wrote in Automobile,
while our baggage and supplies strapped on the rear deck were almost unrecognizable when Syracuse was finally reached.
If you're thinking to yourself, well, at least all that mud probably made for an effective natural sunscreen, you would be wrong. Part of McGargle's transmissions to Automobile noted that all four travelers were so sunburned that it was physically painful to wear gloves or for their collar to be buttoned up tightly. That sucks.
Also, I love the assertion that, well, had we had those mud flaps,
yeah.
You know, everything would have been fine.
Yeah, but they can't pack a big brimmed hat.
As a reminder, this is at the end of day two. The race organizers were expecting these men to be on the road for 42 more days. As far as their journey went, New York State was probably going to be the easy part. On day three, en route to Rochester, Old Scout and Old Steady both got lost several times. Heading to Buffalo on day four, McGargle wrote that Old Steady got so far off the beaten path that the car ended up, quote, in
a section of the country where automobiles appeared to be unknown.
When they tried to ask some local children for directions, one boy commenced to cry violently while a young girl took off running and dove through a barbed wire fence to get away from the strangers. Clearly, things were going well.
Cry violently sounds like something you'd see at like an emo show.
It's like punching the air. And
we'll be right back after these messages.
Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids. Some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I always on television watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton.
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.
Now back to the show.
We won't bog you down with all the bogging down, but to put it simply, it rained all the way to Ohio, and it was frequently so bad that the drivers couldn't tell if they were on a road or if they were just wading through a field covered in water. That sounds insane.
Yeah.
When they could find a road, they were liable to slip right off of it. By the time they reached Cleveland, both cars were already in need of repairs and the drivers a good night's sleep.
This reminds me of when we got that Bronco Sport and we went up to Elfin Hill. We were literally trying to keep it from falling off the road.
That could have gone so much. So we were just testing this Bronco Sport, and it was rain. It was one of those times in LA when finally rains, and it was just so rainy that this dirt road we were going up on this pretty steep hill, turned into peanut butter.
Yeah.
And we're going we made it a quarter way up the hill, and then the car starts sliding and turning. And then it was in that situation where it's 90 degrees with the hill. And I was Joe, we got to stop. So then
you were gunning or not gunning it. You were feathering it, and I was pushing the rear so it wouldn't slide out.
And then Nick was on the other end, right? We were twisting the car to make sure it's straight up and down. That could have gone a lot worse.
Oh, I know. I could have gotten sucked under it.
Yeah. I'm glad when it started to slide sideways, you know, that realization you have when you're why didn't we just stop? Why did we do this?
Yeah.
And shit turns into real life mode where you're oh no.
Yeah. And then,
our
support vehicle was Nick's Volvo.
Yeah.
And we didn't have any...
We didn't have any tow straps.
No toe straps. No, friction
I don't even remember why we were doing that.
It was is the Bronco Sport really that bad? And it was it kind of sucks.
When you take it on a fully inundated dirt road hill with all season tires and limited experience, yeah, you're not going to have a good time.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Tires make a difference.
Yes. Yeah, tires make a huge difference. They make a huge difference.
Peanut butter hill.
It was like driving on peanut butter. So for all the hardship and for all the rain, both crews were in decent spirits when they reached Chicago on May 15th, just over a week after setting off in New York City, 800 miles away. Rain remained in the forecast, but Old Scout and Old Steady had already powered through the brunt of it. There was no way things could get worse, right?
It puts into perspective how close New York and Chicago are to me.
Mm-hmm.
That's like 800 miles is
not... That doesn't seem that far, yeah.
Yeah. Like from here to Portland, I think it's like 1,000 miles.
Here to where?
Portland.
Portland.
That doesn't seem that far away.
So let's fast forward to May 17th. On that day, McGargle reported hitting the road at 5 a.m. When he sat down to write, it was 10:30, and Old Steady had traveled a whopping 64 miles during that time span. The problem, he said, was the mud. The sticky, thick, black mud that sucked the wheels into the earth and caused the engine to overheat as they tried to power out of it. Huss, the mechanic and Old Scout, estimated that the mud sticking to the tires probably added an extra 250 pounds to their machinery. Oh, man.
Yeah, there's no getting around that.
Yeah, and that brings us to another problem. Race founder and route planner James W. Abbott realized right around this time that his map crossed right over the widest and deepest part of Skunk River near Newton, Iowa. Abbott communicated
Skunk River.
Skunk River,
that's
baby.
That's the name of weird names on our on this podcast.
Abbott communicated a change of plan to the two cars, saying that they should take a more indirect but safer route nearer to Des Moines.
I also love this is a time in American history where your route could, like, if there was Google Maps, it would have an alert that's like, this is the part where you're fjording.
Yeah.
You're fording and you're packing up and you're floating across the river because that's how you got places.
Yeah.
You're using the most recent map of their route that they based this off of was drawn by Lewis and Clark.
McGargle and Huss looked at each other and decided, hell no. Instead, they decided they'd forge the depths of Skunk River together, helping each other across. McGargle explained, quote,
first one car would plunge into the water and mud until stuck. Then we would rig our blocks and tackle, attach it to the car axle, and bring each other back to the car still on dry land. By all of us pushing and the free car towing, we managed to work our way across a swamp that everyone told us was impassable.
Huh.
It's a pulley system.
Yeah. Okay.
But they're also, the cars are like, four people moving an 800-pound car.
That sucks. So they had made it across Skunk River, but they had to spend the next day repairing the shorted batteries and other damage. After they crossed that river, Old Steady and Old Scout began to take diverging paths as they approached the Great Plains. They reconvened in Omaha, Nebraska on May 22nd with stories of spooked horses and, quote, hundreds, yes, thousands of pigs that were allowed to roam freely and take over the road, quote,
so that we are obliged to slacken speed and blow the horn for a long distance before we can get a clear road.
The two Oldsmobiles were in much need of repair, so they spent a few days in Omaha fixing up the cars and stocking up on supplies. They bought guns, as much for protection against their fellow travelers as against the wild animals. They bought bigger gas tanks for their trip through the desert, and they stocked up on food, sand tires, and replaced their heavy steamer trunks with smaller wooden boxes.
That's smart.
They took off on the 24th for their next big excursion. Then, on May 27th, Old Steady fell through a bridge. How did the men survive? How did they get their car back to dry land? We have no idea, unfortunately, because McGargle's sole concern was recording only the damage to the car.
I do think this is great that we had their firsthand account.
Yeah.
But in this instance, it gets into his head. It's just like, oh, it's the same thing you do when your car breaks down and you're like, all right, so I got to fix the radiator. Which one am I going to do first? Like, that's all your characters.
Yeah. They're on a mission. Yep. And they're very focused.
Quote,
the fall broke both side springs.
He wrote,
the strut rod on the front axle and bent both the front and rear axles.
His right-hand man, Bart Stanchfield, made some quick repairs that saw them make it into town. Even in town, though, they didn't have the supplies to make a permanent fix. That didn't happen until they reached Boise, Idaho. Old Steady was able to hit the road the next day, but it was fragile. Now, whenever they hit a bump, something would break, and they'd have to spend half the day fixing it.
That's such a, like, imagine being all the way to Idaho and just having to deal with this every day.
Meanwhile, also, how much do you start hating each other?
Oh, at this point?
Really, you know,
like McGargle.
So much stress.
McGargle. Meanwhile, old Scout got stuck, quote, in a very bad mud hole. And Huss and Weigel spent hours digging themselves out, only to get stuck again a few miles down the road. Still, they had about a day's lead over the competition, and they were determined to maintain that lead at all costs. Still, it was great news for James Abbott, who, after all, organized this race in part to show why the U.S. needed better roads.
He's wringing his hands every time he hears they break down.
He told the Wyoming Semi-Weekly Tribune that, quote,
"The present trip of the two Oldsmobiles will prove an incalculable value as it demonstrates so strikingly the need of good roads in the Western country. During the past 2 weeks, the Oldsmobiles have lost almost a week on their scheduled time as a result of rains, which placed the roads in deplorable condition and which shows that the ordinary rains, which may be expected each year, tend to render most Western roads impassable."
It's kind of amazing that there needed to be an argument made for this. Now we take roads for granted, absolutely, here.
This is a time when it's like you were taking a big old wagon out there and you're taking your horses out there.
And so and a horse is strong enough to pull you out of any mud. And
also, I mean, the motivations for going out west too were very much based, I think, in isolation and, you know, making your own kind of homestead for yourself and like being alone. Certainly there are communities in the West, you know, not everyone is just by themselves doing it in cabins and stuff, but like, you know, the cities were on the East Coast. The New West was,
you claim your land, you populate, you have your own stake,
you do your own thing.
And then like the miners.
Yeah. So like, why the hell should I want there to be roads? You know, I don't want more people coming through here.
Yeah.
I think was probably a mindset that some people had. So yeah, it's just amazing though, that it took something like this to make,
and that, I mean,
eventually the interstate system happened.
It was years until that happened. Yeah, like decades. Like late 50s is when it started.
Yeah. Making that final jaunt into Portland proved just to be as challenging as the rest of the trip. Abbott predicted that the trip would be a quick one, but the moment Old Scout left Laramie, it fell into a sinkhole and took all day to retrieve. I just think these guys are bad at driving.
Yeah, I think so.
When they got back on the road, Huss claimed the roads were so bad that he didn't know how the car lived through it. Quote,
"We forded five big creeks, driving over rocks and stones and so much sagebrush that Old Scout's radiator looked like a badly twisted piece of tin,"
he wrote. When they spotted the Union Pacific Rail Line, they decided they'd spend the rest of the trip sticking as close to the tracks as humanly possible. Meanwhile, Old Steady had to spend the night repairing a damaged engine. Then McGargle and Stanchfield ran out of oil and filled the tank with an oil-like substance they found at a local store that unfortunately turned into a sticky gum as soon as they got moving.
Yeah, of course it did. This is what the manual is talking about.
Yep.
You know your engine better than you know your horse. You wouldn't feed your horse
sticky gum.
That horse would be chewing all day.
Yeah. They had to hire a team, ironically, of horses to drag the car back into town,
which disqualified from the race, and
where they would take on even more repairs. And by that point, Old Scout was 3.5 days ahead.
So I just did the math. $1,000 at this time is about $36,000.
Oh, wow.
Is this, in your mind, worth $36,000 to do?
Well, it was the average annual salary.
Yeah, that sounds right. $36,000.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know. For a factory worker? That seems pretty.
That distance meant that Huss and Weigel avoided a gnarly storm system that rolled into their wake. Behind the wheel of Old Steady, McGargle and Stanchfield were first overcome by snow and then a hailstorm. When they tried to outrun the hail, their Oldsmobile got stuck in a river that just kept rising.
Good Lord.
And they had to find a wary local sheep farmer to use his horses to free them yet again. Huss and Weigel
Can you help us? We got our car stuck in the river.
What's a car?
We got a car stuck in the river.
Yeah, I know what a river is. What's a car?
Just give us the horses.
Huss and Weigel.
Do you know more about a car than you do your horses?
I don't even know what a car is.
All right, then give us your horses.
Huss and Weigel still kept their lead, but it wasn't growing bigger just yet. They had their own setbacks. They had lost the day driving in the wrong direction, then managed to fall down a 12-foot embankment that damaged their car even further.
They are is this always at night?
That's what I think so, dude. A lot of... As they hit into the desert, they realized that they'd needed way more than just sand tires to make it through comfortably. Without anything but the clothes on their backs, which I assume were disgusting at this point, they were freezing from the moment the sun went down. They also didn't bring enough water, leaving them dizzy from thirst.
Guys, come on.
When they hit the mountains, newspapers reported that all four men caught something called mountain fever. The symptoms of which included, quote, aches from every bone and muscle and a burning fever with intermittent chills that made them, quote, most miserable. It got so bad that at one point, McGargle left Stanchfield on his own for a few days to recover, driving ahead on his own. They later made up again when Stanchfield was well enough to use a train. But it wasn't like McGargle was doing all that well himself. God. He reported bleeding from the nose, mouth, and ears as he kept climbing the mountain. Can you imagine
not
bleeding from
bleeding
your
from his anus?
He was too embarrassed to report that.
He reported everything else.
Yeah.
Good Lord.
For Huss and Weigel, at least.
This is also, this is at a time where you're like, healthcare is at the point where you're like, well, I'm bleeding from my mouth, eyes, nose, and ears. I better see how this turns out.
Yeah. Oh, you just got mountain fever.
All right.
You either got to let it pass or you're going to die.
Yeah. For Huss and Weigel, at least, it was nearly over. On Wednesday, June 21st, after a few days of navigating treacherous mountain slopes, Old Scout pulled into Portland, Oregon, 44 days, 6 hours, 28 minutes after leaving New York City. They had arrived exactly 62 minutes before the start of the 5th annual National Good Roads Convention. The very event they'd been hoping to make.
Hell yeah.
As such, the roads were lined with people cheering them on, amazed at the fact that the two men had managed to drive across the United States of America. All told, if they had traveled an estimated 3,750 miles during that time frame, that they averaged out a speed of 3.53 miles per hour, driving roughly 85 miles a day.
That's like a slow walk.
That's bad.
Yeah, you'd walk about 15 minutes a mile.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Quote,
"You would be astonished at what an automobile will stand and still be in working order,"
Huss told Motor World magazine. He described that he and Weigel had come upon a stream at one point in their trip. They knew they wouldn't be able to cross it slowly, so they, quote,
"took a swift run and plunged in. The momentum carried the automobile through the stream. We poured the water out of the engine, and we were going again in 5 minutes." That's actually amazing. Pretty cool.
Yeah, we've all done it. And then you get to the other side, and you're like, yeah. We got it back.
A full week later, on June 28th, Old Steady finally made it to Portland. Despite the late arrival, they were, too, welcomed by an adoring crowd of people wearing with gauges in their ears.
Gauges in their ears and Carhartt pants.
That's right. And because they learned that they'd lost the contest several days prior, they were able to enjoy the last miles without rushing.
This is a scene cut to the two of them gazing into each other's eyes with the wind in their hair.
And then
hair.
They fall down a 12-foot embankment.
According to Automobile Magazine, quote,
"Old Scout is, to all appearances, none the worse for the hard knocks it has received."
That was probably extremely generous considering all the machine had been through.
It also is probably accurate given the condition that these cars left with.
Yeah.
It's like a piece of wood.
It's
on
like
wheels.
Wood. Yeah.
Yes. Looks about like that.
Yep. Imagine being like a snarky writer for Automobile Magazine back in 1908.
Oh, people don't want to ride horses anymore. People just don't like horses.
you think Automobile Magazine at the turn of the century was like, primarily horse?
Yeah, a horse was like a manual transmission for them.
I don't like all this new tech in cars, like a flywheel.
Yeah. A gauge telling me how fast I'm going? What is this, the nanny state?
Which they didn't have that, though.
Because they'd primarily followed rail lines, it was possible for the men in both cars to transmit their thoughts and impressions to various newspapers around the country as they made the trek. And people all across America had followed along. By the end of the race, it was clear that there was a desperate need for a better road network, but it would likely require a whole lot of work to make that happen. After all, After the race, Haas said, quote,
"My remarks about some of the roads over which we passed would be unfit to print."
The time that they're doing this race, for reference, these almost every Western territory that they're going through had only been acquired by the U.S. Like, it's 1904, a lot, you know, there's like 19 or 1848.
Yeah.
You know, these are places that weren't part of the United States.
Yes, sure.
Pretty recent.
For about 20, you know, yeah. Only 20 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Our producer, Audrey, just said Arizona hadn't been incorporated as a state yet.
Well, then most of these are still territory.
Yeah.
And, you know, so.
Haas and McGargle both went on to forge careers in the driving world, taking on many of the early turn-of-the-century long-distance races and reliability runs. Oldsmobile had totally lost track of both Old Scout and Old Steady by 1931. Both cars had been sold to a car enthusiast, but no one is quite sure what happened next. Eventually, someone confessed to have bought Old Scout, which was restored by Oldsmobile. That's cool. In 1904, it took Old Scout 44 days to cross the United States, from New York City to Portland, Oregon. On May 3rd, 1971, car and driver writer Brock Yates, his son, and his buddies Steve Smith and Jim Williams traveled from the Red Ball Garage in New York City to Redondo Beach, California, behind the wheel of a 1971 Dodge Custom Sportsman van they named Moontrash 2. Driving an average of 70 miles an hour, it took them 40 hours and 51 minutes to reach their destination. So basically, the 1904 cross-country Oldsmobile contest was the slowest cannonball ever. Even though James W. Abbott was so enthusiastic about the outcome of the race he'd organized, it wouldn't be until the 1960s that it became common to be able to take a paved two-lane road to pretty much anywhere in America. And even then, it was less so average Americans could take a long-distance pleasure cruise, and more so the U.S. military could easily access both coasts. But there was an immediate impact. The very fact that those two frail-looking Oldsmobiles actually managed to make it to Portland proved that American cars were pretty damn resilient, and also proved to be a great marketing tactic for Oldsmobile. The whole contest was limited in terms of development, considering that two equally matched cars were pitted against one another. But that didn't matter. Against all odds, four men had raced across the country. They had made it. And in doing so, they changed the course of American automotive history.
It's amazing that people did this. It's this time.
It's crazy. So crazy, dude. Yeah, that is a feat. I can't even imagine. Dude, getting so sunburned you can't even like button your shirt on day two.
Yeah.
That sucks. That was awesome. Thank you, Liz. Elizabeth Blackstock always delivers.
She's a great writer.
Great writer. Go follow her.
We got three more scripts coming that she wrote in the next couple months. Yeah. So stay tuned.
Go follow Liz on Blue Sky if you haven't already. We got listener mail this week and looks like some snacks in a big box. Here, make sure that doesn't block your face there.
This letter is from Dan Hapner. What's up, Wink Wink Nation? My name is Dan and have been a fan of the channel and podcast for some time now. He's got really good handwriting.
He does.
I'm great. An active duty engineman in the Navy and in currently stationed in Japan. I have a 45-minute commute to and from work and will listen to Past Gas in the Big Three almost daily. Thank you for that.
Thanks, dude.
I know you have been reviewing road trip snacks and I wanted to send you some snacks from Japan. I also have a suggestion for an episode for Past Gas. I would love to hear an episode on Ivan Iron Man Stewart. That's right. Crazy. We haven't done one. I'll definitely put it on the list. He was an off-road racer competing from the mid-70s up until the late 90s and is a 15-time champion.
Wow.
He is best known for his 1993 Toyota T100 trophy truck. Yeah, oh, dude. I know this, dude. Yeah. Hell yeah.
Yep. One of the goats.
That he raced with.
He also had a video game.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you did.
The wheels that's you right. just spin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That he raced without a co-driver to compensate for the T100's lack of power compared to American V8 powered trucks.
That's crazy.
He competed against.
Wow.
Finally, I want to thank everyone involved in creating the laughs, knowledge, and quality content over the years and providing myself and many other servicemen and women with a little piece of home. Dan Hapner. Dude, hey,
thanks,
Dan. Thank you
great,
so much.
Great letter.
He sent us all these snacks. The thing is, people hate the road and snack segment because it's literally just chewing snacks in your ear.
Yeah.
We get it. So we are moving the road and snack segment to our Instagram. So if you want to check it out, we will be reviewing all those crazy Japanese snacks. There's like squid, dried squid. There's like chocolate covered potato chips.
Smoked dried squid.
It's
the one unopened bag. Right.
I don't know. Yeah.
Dan also sent us some patches.
Oh, the patches are super sick.
Let's see. Yeah. Here.
You're going to have to go to YouTube to see them because they're honestly amazing.
The Naval Beach Unit. So this is a really cool one.
So good. Carpe Noctum.
Dude. This is
any beach.
This is
anytime.
The sickest patch I've ever seen. Just get a good shot of that. So yeah. Seize the day, seize the night. Any beach, anytime.
So, so sick. With like a stormtrooper type helmet with a skull in it.
Yeah. So Dan, I think he's from Naval Beach Unit 7. These guys are they're based in Japan. And I went on YouTube to see if there's any videos, and NBU 7, they specialize in like beach landings.
Oh, sick.
And use like hovercrafts and stuff like
that.
Yeah. Super sick.
Dude.
So
we might have to go make a video
shout out NBU 7. This is also the like sickest, but if I see someone coming towards me with this patch on their uniform,
you won't.
That's scary as hell. That's a scary ass patch.
If you see it, you're too late. Yeah. It's too late.
Any beach, anytime. That is hard.
Thank you for writing in, Dan. And if you want to send us snacks, send it to P.O. Box 84, Inglewood, California, 90306. You check it periodically, so give us time if you don't get a response back. And email us at passgas@donutmedia.com if you have any suggestions for episodes or just want to chat.
Yeah.
And thank you for listening.
Thank you, Joe. Follow Joe G. Weber at Joe G. Weber. Follow Bart at Bids Bardo. Follow me at Nolan J. Sykes if you'd like. Big thanks to Edgar Grajeda and Audrey Holden, as always, holding it down.
Liz Blackstock for writing this episode.
Liz, you know you're the best. She knows that. I don't got to tell her that. And yeah, we will see you next time.
Bye.
Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids. Some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I always on television watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton?
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.